And our special guest tonight, Jim Steinmeier, as we talk about his work, Charles Fort, the man who invented the supernatural. Some great stories ahead on Coast to Coast AM. Jim, let's pick up on some of the areas that Fort keyed in on and what he was interested in.
You have to remember that he was doing this in these books were published from between 1919 and 1932. And so these were very often the first time that the public had heard about these subjects. And they didn't have the names that we now associate with them. For instance, as I mentioned, he wrote about UFOs. They just weren't called UFOs or flying saucers at the time. He wrote about mysterious airships that were seen going back for hundreds of years. He gave accounts of them. And those accounts were used by later writers of UFOs when they went back into the literature.
And people were seeing strange things then, right?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, his point is that these come from scientific journals and from newspapers and very respectable journals. He's going back through libraries and finding accounts of these. He wrote about not a lot, but he introduced the subject of cryptozoology. I mean, that's what we would call it today.
Yep.
He was writing about mysterious animals that were seen that there were no explanations for. There's a story that I'm sure some of your listeners are familiar with, a really amazing story that's popularly called The Devil in Devonshire, which was a series of biped hoof prints, two-legged hoof prints that were all over the snows of Devonshire one morning in the mid-1800s. And there were very good accounts of it. I mean, people woke up, there was a light snowfall, and it looked just as if a two-legged animal with hooves had walked over the countryside.
Like Pan.
Or as they called it, the devil.
Yeah.
And, I mean, there were very mysterious situations with this where there was no other way that these could have been produced, and they went up over walls. It was just phenomenal, and they were tracked for miles and miles. He wrote about manna falling from the sky, something that really could be eaten, just as if it was described in the Bible. He wrote about blood falling from the sky and had dozens of accounts of it. He wrote about stones falling from the sky, fish, as I said, frogs falling from the sky. He wrote about people disappearing and appearing mysteriously. It was a long section. I think that to many people, the accounts of Caspar Hauser, the boy that appeared in Nuremberg, who had mysterious psychic abilities and couldn't account for where he had come from, that really came from Fort. To many Americans, that account was popularized by Fort.
How did he find these stories without an internet, Jim? <huh? laughs>
Without an internet, exactly. He was... this is, I think, where his shyness worked to his advantage. He went every single day to the New York Public Library for, it's hard to tell, I think for about 5 years before he produced the first book.
My.
And he went through journals. He wasn't checking out books. He sat in the reading room and went through scientific journals, popular journals, anything that had natural phenomena in it. And accounts of it.
And took those notes.
And then went back, had lunch. I mean, he was a very simple man. He went back, his wife made lunch for him, and he sat in the afternoon and wrote. And then he went back the next day to the New York Public Library. He got tired of the New York Public Library because when his first book was published, he was enormously proud of it, and he went to the public library and was asked to be shown a copy of it. And they went and showed him a copy, and he asked about the Dewey Decimal Classification. And they said that's the classification for crank literature.
That's funny.
And he left New York. He got on a boat and went to London. And he started studying at the British Museum.
He stayed there for a couple of years.
He stayed there for several years and gathered the material for his later books, principally in London, at least his next two books in London. And then he came back to New York. He did eventually go back to New York Public Library. But his pride was wounded, as is understandable. I mean, he was very serious about these subjects and put a lot of work into it.
Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, to me, one of the most amazing things that he left us with is the Bermuda Triangle. Now, I say that because Fort didn't write about the Bermuda Triangle and didn't write about anything happening in Bermuda. And, of course, many of those things happened after he died.
Berlitz did, right?
The person who coined that phrase was Vincent Gaddis. And Vincent Gaddis was a Fortean, was a popular magazine writer and book writer, and he was a Fortean. He was a member of the Fortean Society. What's interesting is that that phrase, Bermuda Triangle, is taken directly from Fort's second book. Fort wrote about a little area in England. This is when he went over to England to study.
And that was New Lands, the book, right?
That's exactly right, New Lands. And he described something he called the London Triangle. And he bounded it by three cities, and he talked about the way that there were so many oddities within this triangle. And it's clear that what happened is that a generation later, when Vincent Gaddis started gathering this material on the Bermuda Triangle, he named it as a tribute to Fort. That basically, he took Fort's example and now found the Bermuda Triangle by bounding it within this area, just as Fort had written a generation earlier about the London Triangle.
And then others would just pick up on
it. Others would pick up on it. And that was true of many of these phenomena. Fort, there were so many subjects that he addressed in these kind of strange collections and his own little humorous theories and asides and jokes about it and his comments on it, that for several generations afterwards and still today, which is why I say many generations, people are mining Fort's books. They're using them as inspiration. They sometimes take the material right out of them, or they take small subjects from Fort and then keep researching from there.
I am convinced that the 1959 to 1961 show, One Step Beyond, was based on many of his stories. Because as a kid, I would remember some, and they did those 30-minute shows on Stones Falling.
Oh, yeah.
Frogs Falling, Strange People. I think they used the Book of the Damned and the rest of his volumes to do that TV show.
It's really become a kind of reference book for many of these subjects. The only shame of it, I think, I think that's grand. And I think that in that sense, absolutely, it's wonderful that there's a movement called Fortianism and that people recognize it and recognize his contribution. I think the shame of it, and I think this happens with a lot of philosophical movements of any kind, at Fort would be horrified to hear that we were calling this a philosophical movement, because he was doubtful about all of that. But I think that the shame of it is that people stopped reading Fort. They started gathering the material, and then they talked about the material. But what got lost in all of this is Fort's voice, because he had such an interesting way of talking about these subjects and both scaring us with them and also making them friendly. And joking our way through these subjects and kind of letting us hear his voice, that we've sort of lost him, but the subjects are still here today.
They didn't need him?
I would say, well, of course, I think what's been proven is exactly that. I don't mean to be critical of him as a writer. I think a great deal of his books. But I think that's exactly what happened, is the subjects are so fascinating that they didn't need him. That once these subjects were introduced to the public, they were taken up by other authors, and they were reinterpreted, regathered, researched in different forms, put together in different ways. And of course, you didn't need Fort to tell you that anymore. But it's a shame, because I think it's like a lot of these things. If you go back to the original source, if you read how these were first presented, and it isn't that long ago, it's in the 1920s and early 30s, there's a kind of freshness to it and a kind of wit to it. And it's quite... You really have to wrap your head around it, because, you know, to read someone who's truly agnostic, you know, to read someone who truly is open-minded about everything, we just don't experience that. It's something you really don't experience in everyday life.
His four works were different but similar, weren't they?
They really were. It's really interesting you say that. In fact, I'm glad you said that, because I know a number of your listeners probably have on their shelves the collected works of Charles Fort, and
probably,
maybe. I've made them go and open it up, and now I'm going to tell them something so they can read it. They're going to start at the Book of the Damned, and they're going to open it up, and they're going to go, oh, I can't make my way through this. This is unbelievable. You open it up to his third book called Low, and it was a kind of humorous title,
yep.
Low. It was about pointing to the skies. And
just
L-O.
L-O,
Low. And Low was Fort at the height of his powers, and it's beautifully written, and it's friendly, and you get a feeling for him. And he had already had two successful books, and he was quite relaxed about how he was presenting this material. And Low is a brilliant, brilliant book, brilliantly presented. And then go on to read his last book, which was Wild Talents. And Wild Talents it has more autobiographical and more interesting insights into him in it than any other book. It was the last book he wrote. It's not the most authoritative because it's about people having wild talent.
And why the last book? Did he just, he died?
He died. He literally saw the book on his deathbed, was given the copy of it from the printer.
Oh, my.
In fact, his obituary came out the day that the review came out in most newspapers. But Wild Talent is just a fascinating book, and it really gives you a flavor for him. And then once you've done that, go back to the Book of the Damned and New Lands, which are his first two books. And they're quite dense. And at that point, he was a younger man. He was trying to put this in a new form. And it's slightly pretentious, and it takes a little bit to get through. But I would say that if you read Lowe and you read Wild Talents, you'll have a really good taste for him.
Jim, if you met him, if you had this opportunity today, if you went back into time, what would you talk with him about?
Oh, that's a good
question. I mean, because you're his biographer, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, that's a really good question. I'll tell you what I would love to know about is his travel around the world for 2 years. He traveled around the world for 2 years on virtual. I worked it out in the book. It's like 72 cents a day. And it really was on 72 cents a day because he was on a stipend. He was on like $25 a month that was being sent to him. And his whole purpose was to gather adventures, gather experiences. He didn't write anything down. He didn't want to take a single note. He just wanted the experiences. And he came back to New York, and a neighbor who was confined to his rooms, a man who was an invalid, told him, he said, oh, that's a terrible idea. He said, you don't want to learn a little bit about everything. You want to learn a lot about a few things.
And
Fort never talked about those experiences around the world, never talked about that trip again.
What?
There's almost no account of it. There's a very brief account he wrote for a newspaper, which is really the only thing we know about it. But he, after gathering all that information, after deciding that he would use all that to write, that was his writing career, he never used that information. He just made a right turn and started collecting information on these anomalies.
Are you familiar with any of the works of Zachariah Sitchin? He wrote a book called The Twelfth Planet.
Oh, yes, yes,
okay,
yes.
Then a series of books.
Yeah.
He in Fort probably would have gotten along.
I think absolutely, absolutely. It's interesting that Buckminster Fuller was a big fan of Fort and thought he might have met him because they were in the same circles in New York. Although, again, Fort was always the quiet man sitting in the corner next to the punch bowl.
He wasn't. You didn't even know he walked in.
That's right. He was not there shaking hands. But, Fuller was an admirer of Fort. And he wrote, and I think this is such a beautiful way of putting it, Fuller wrote that Fort fell in love with the world that jilted him. He was completely in love with the world. He was fascinated by the world. And at the same time, it was everything about the world that had made him skeptical, socially and personally and business-wise. I mean, he had really been rejected by kind of all the institutions. And yet what's amazing is how he took that kind of doubt and pointed it in a direction to fascinate everybody and still is fascinating people with these subjects today.
Would you consider him, Charles Fort, was he bizarre?
No. I really think that's a mistake. I mean, one of the things that, you know, one of the things that people still ask, you know, I mean, to put it in a vernacular that is kind of jarring, you know, was he a crank? You know, who was this guy? Was he a nut? Was he a crank? You know, do we take this guy seriously? What do we do? I don't think he was at all. I think he was incredibly shy to the point of being somewhat antisocial.
Huh.
And I think that's just how he lived his life. But I think that he was, quite the opposite. I think he was quite reasoned in everything that he thought. And that's certainly the accounts we have from people. He wasn't a guy who would lecture you on crazy subjects.
You know, I when I was producing my TV newscasts back in my 20s, mm-hmm. they coined the phrase for me, Captain Bizarre. And that stuck for years. And, you know, I would do things, Jim, like, you know, if there was a science story that came out that said, you know, hamsters sleep 3 hours a day and they run on the wheels for 20, I'd bring a hamster into my news set and have the anchorman play with this thing while it was running around. I remember once we had a UFO flap in Detroit, and some folks said that they had filmed it, 8mm film in those days. We didn't have little video cameras. And so I had it developed. We had not looked at it. My thing was I wanted the anchor people to look at this thing cold. And I went, once they were starting to, and I had the anchor guy standing up, and we had to get clearance because it was a unionized TV station. So it was the International Association of Television and Radio Artists, IATSE. So they, and engineers, they had to give him approval to turn the movie projector on. So there we are in this news set. There's a screen, a projector, and the anchor guy's doing it. And he's ready to hit this film, and it hits me. What if I'm being taken? What if these are, you know, like horrible movies or something, and I'm starting to panic?
Right.
And he hits the movie projector, and the lights come on, and you see a family outside running around. It was silent, of course. And, you know, you see a little object zoom by. You don't know what it is. It could have been a street sign, for all I know. And that was it. But I would do things like that. They coined the phrase Captain Bizarre on me, but I loved things. I didn't know Charles Fort a lot, but I knew the stories of Charles Fort.
That kind of one step beyond thing that was in popular culture.
Yeah, all of them, and I was obsessed with it.
It's interesting to me that he was a meticulous researcher, and I have seen letters from him to people where he asks them to track down a story. Later in his career, he often did that. He would write to an area, and he would ask about something that he had read about. And I know from several examples that I saw that when the story didn't pan out, it went away. It didn't make it into his books.
In your work, in your research on him, could you conclude what he believed in?
He clearly... It's funny because, you know, when my book came out, I inherited... all of Charles Fort's bizarre criticisms from the public. I had people scratching my head over this biography. I thought it was a nice, simple little biography of an interesting character. But I had people say everything from, you know, unfortunately, you know, the author is obviously a tinfoil hat believer, you know, or he wouldn't have written about this. To also people saying, you know, unfortunately, the author doesn't understand that Charles Fort was a skeptic about everything and didn't believe anything, was, you know, didn't believe a single thing about the supernatural, that all of his books were parody.
Wow.
So, I mean, he's still being debated about that. I do think there are real theories. I think, especially early in his books, he doubts the nature of, he has incredible doubts about astronomy. He's very
skeptical. In what way?
Very skeptical about the claims of astronomers. He finds that their predictions are often wildly off, and I think there's an awful lot of truth to that. He was reading newspaper accounts at the time of predictions about heavenly bodies.
And these were astronomers that have since gone on to die and have great names for themselves.
Oh, no, absolutely, right? Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I think that, you know, I think what Fort's right about, and I make this point in the book, is that, you know, we have to be able, and I was criticized for saying this in reviews as well, as you can imagine. We have to be able to laugh at scientists the same way we can now laugh at priests.
Yeah, I see what you mean.
Okay, and Fort, that is a keystone of what Fort's saying. I mean, these are human beings. These are human, and I also think that you really only understand science. Also, you don't understand science by elevating it to some kind of religious fervor. You understand it by understanding that it's a very human thing, that these theories are being changed and evolved and worked with. And Fort was very skeptical of the status that astronomers had, that their calculations were perfect, that it was a kind of perfect science, that they would, and that was the title, Lo. They'd point up to the sky and they'd say, Lo, and they would find something there.
Jim, when we come back, let's talk about what it meant to be a Fortean, how that happened. There's also a magazine out there called the Fortean Times. A friend of mine, Rosemary Ellen Guiley, writes for it as well. So there's still interest in Charles Fort. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Next hour, we'll take your phone calls with Jim Steinmeier. So get ready. But I'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Jim Steinmeier, what is the Fortean Society? How did that start?
The Fortean Society was formed by friends of Charles Fort in 1930, principally by a friend of his young friend named Tiffany Thayer, who was a pulp novelist who helped with his last two books, kind of helped him find a publisher and put the books together. And Tiffany Thayer, it was founded a couple years before Fort died, and they had a couple meetings, and it was really a kind of a loose association of friends. And then shortly after Charles Fort died, Thayer put it back together again in a much more formal sense and had a newsletter and took memberships and published something called a publication called Info, which was which furthered the sort of oddities and the subjects that Fort was looking into. And then since then, there have been a number of Fortean organizations, the International Fortean Organization, and there are local Fortean organizations still to this day. And the word Fortean is kind of used as an adjective to describe the subjects they're interested in.
And they take it seriously, don't they?
Oh, absolutely. I think that what Fortean is in that sense is a word that's a kind of shorthand for people that are interested in these subjects, a kind of wide range of these subjects, interested in reading about them, interested in gathering information when they have a chance to do that, and disseminating the information. And sometimes in classifying it as well, I mean, really, really doing some hard work, you know, by charting things and gathering information together. I also think that, to me, the word Fortean has a kind of attitude about it, too. When it's really at its best, and I think that publication, the Fortean Times out of the UK, which is available today, which is a collection of a monthly publication about oddities and strange things in the world, strange talents and odd things that happen in the news. I think there's a kind of irreverence to it and a very nice, light sense of humor about it, which is a kind of skeptical tone. I mean, meaning it's skeptical about everything, the way Fort was, and it just looks at these things in a kind of wry, clever way, as opposed to, you know, a heavy sense that, you know, we're gathering science here. It's really a kind of commentary, a kind of social commentary, and I think that the very best Fortean, really true to Fort, has that sort of touch to it. That it's about looking at the world in an interesting way, as opposed to trying to make their own philosophy.
Did he ever get into, as we do, the conspiracy end of what might be happening on this planet as well?
I would say that is not where Fort went, and that is something that Tiffany Thayer brought to the Fortean organization later. My guess would be that would have been a stretch for Fort.
Yeah.
And I'm speculating, because I don't think Fort might have argued that that's a belief, that a belief in a, like a conspiracy or something kind of something grand happening like that is a kind of religious belief. You know, it's almost like transferring your faith in a big organization.
Well, in those days, you believed almost everything government told you.
Yes. But I think his point is that he believed none of it. And so I think what he might do is argue with you that, you know, that trusting that there's a secret organization, trusting that there's a secret agenda is just like trusting in Roman Catholicism or Darwinism or any of the things that he might have argued with, you know, Einstein, that, you know, look skeptically at all of this.
Now, you said there were 40,000 notes. 40,000 notes. Where are they?
They are in the New York Public Library.
They're just waiting there, huh?
They are waiting there. I've been through them.
Can anybody?
One has to file a reader's card and get access to them. They're in the special collections. I don't know if that's the full 40. It's very hard to tell whether that's the full 40,000 that Tiffany Thayer inherited. Those certainly are the notes that ended up there. Whether they're all there. I've been through them in terms of kind of how they're classified and what's represented in them. What people will see who are fans of Fort are a lot of the original kind of source notes for things that you'll recognize. In other words, the later books, the last two books especially, you'll see the notes in them. But it's interesting seeing kind of how he took notes and how he cross-referenced things by category. And he took they're meticulous, very sloppy handwriting, but all tiny little torn pieces of paper that are gathered in bundles with rubber bands or tied with string that are put together in certain categories. And that was, you can see that that was kind of how he organized his thoughts. He had this pile of notes, and it was like a collection. Just as you said, when he was a kid, he was a kind of a scientist. You know, he collected birds' eggs, and he collected feathers, and he collected rocks, and he thought of himself as a naturalist. That sort of obsession, that sort of collection, turned into these collections of facts. And he collected these notes and would organize them and move them around and, you know, reclassify them in different categories. And that was his way of getting to these books.
Was there anything that scared him that you might have been able to find about his work? I mean, was there anything he just took so seriously it frightened him?
He absolutely had odd psychic experiences. And it's interesting that he didn't talk about them, or he wrote very little about them. His wife wrote about them, and he described them to Dreiser. He had a couple of experiences when he was absolutely at his most dire. I mean, he was penniless as a writer at a certain point in his life when Theodore Dreiser kind of rediscovered him. And in his depths, he had very odd experiences about the one thing he talked to Dreiser about was sensing an orange glow in the room, in a corner of the room, their little one-room apartment in Hell's Kitchen. And the kind of feeling that gave him, and he knew that it something was changing. And it was as if the room were on fire, but not really. And it was, in fact, just that. It did change his luck. That it was a warmth that suddenly changed his life. There was another time when he found food, and this all kind of fit into his philosophy that things were there. That there's a kind of continuity to the way the world works. That everything is connected. And he, at a time when he didn't know how they were going to eat, a box of food was delivered to him, and he never could get the answer to it. It wasn't the neighbors. It wasn't delivered accidentally. He never found the source for it. Now, whether it was a Good Samaritan, whether it was someone who knew his situation, he never had an account for it. But it was part of his belief that there's a kind of continuity and a connection to all things. And you can see that he definitely had experiences like that. His wife talked about ghostly experiences that they had after his father died, of actually experiencing his ghost in their apartment. But it's interesting that Fort didn't write about those things. He considered a lot of that human testimony to be unreliable. He was very, very skeptical, very careful, I should say, about accounts of spiritualist things, poltergeists, etc. He has a little of that in his last book, but he's very careful about it because he considers that that's kind of not good testimony, not good evidence, if it comes from personal experience.
Jim, tell me what he said about these flying machines of that era. That fascinates me.
He gives accounts of odd airships in the sky, and he has them over a range of years, and they're taken out of newspapers and scientific journals. They're taken out of accounts of people who saw them. They're almost none of his descriptions are of saucer shapes. That was a generation later when people were describing them, but these are often cigar shaped, which of course people are still talking about today. It's a very common occurrence. But he writes about them from the 1800s, especially from the 1800s, late 1800s, into his present time, before any kind of airship of that kind. And he does speculate. He wrote a letter to a newspaper and speculated whether we were being monitored, whether there wasn't, and this is again before any kind of ancient astronaut theory, whether there wasn't another life force from another planet. At that time, the planet everybody said was Mars, because that was what Percival Lowell was looking at.
Right.
Whether there wasn't someone looking at us, and that the only evidence we had of it today, as he wrote in this letter, was that occasionally we have evidence of them in the skies, and that otherwise they've withdrawn. So he did posit theories like that where he wonders, he kind of publicly wonders whether this might be happening. But the airships are a small occurrence. He puts them in with oddities in the sky, which some of which sound very natural. You know, enormous. He describes a fall of hail, one of which is roughly the size of an elephant. You know, a hailstone, and you know, kind of asks, how are we supposed to account for this? You know, as he jokes, and you know, this is part of Ford is, you know, if you say that, you know, water vapor or water in the air coming together forms that, you know, wouldn't you expect out of a dust storm to have blocks of granite fall from the sky?
You know, his theory of these creatures that fell from the sky, that they got dumped into some soup, some Sargasso sea.
Yes.
And somehow they got sucked out of there or something.
He speculates about whether there isn't a kind of gigantic Sargasso sea, meaning a kind of junkyard.
Like a junkyard, a pool.
A pool in the sky.
Yeah.
And whether this isn't close to us in some way. Because he's truly puzzled by things falling from the sky with some regularity, that there would be a fall of frogs from the sky in an area, and then 4 days later another fall of frogs from the sky in the same area, and he says, you know, what is it that's accounting for that? And he puts forward theories, and you know, you scratch your head and you say, well, is he really saying that there's a sea above us? And I think to some extent, some of these theories, he kind of poked, it's like poking a stick at people. You know, it gets you thinking about it. And it sounds a little crazy. And he certainly does things where he walks over the edge. I mean, he talks about, one of his famous quotes is that, you know, talking about airships in the sky and the possibility of being visited, is he says, I think we're property, which is that, you know, something owns us, something thinks it owns us. And that, you know, that's what this is all about, is that they're looking at us. You know, we don't know it, but we're owned.
He died, unfortunately, a few years before War of the Worlds. I wonder how he would have handled that broadcast, huh?
It's really interesting. It's very interesting what he would have made of modern media in any sense, and certainly, you know, the effect that would have had on him. He resisted talking on a telephone all his life. He probably spoke on the phone 20 times.
Jeez.
Not I don't think from any phobia. I just think it just wasn't necessary to him. It wasn't part of his world.
Is anybody picking up the torch now and running with it like he did?
There are certainly great writers. I mean, I think the Fortean Times, the UK publication, does a brilliant job of with these subjects and has such a wonderful touch and has such a great range of subjects like this. I do think that people are picking up. You know, I can't talk about it, but I will tell you this, George. Your readers will be interested to hear. Charles Fort has a relative who recently contacted me, and he really is a relative. I know from my research who this is, and he is just getting into this field, and he's trained as a scientist, and this is his interest. And I think you're going to hear a lot about it. I wish I could say more. I can't right now, but you know what? I think in another year or two, you'll be interested in a new researcher.
Oh, that's fascinating. That really is. Of all the topics he handled, Jim, which ones do you think were the most believable? You.
Oh, I think it's very hard to argue with a number, you know, with just about any topic that he enters into. I think his observations on the fallibility of science and the limits of science are, you know, they really should be looked at because it's, as I say, it's part of the human way that science works. I mean, we make a mistake of idealizing science and thinking that it's infallible and that it never changes. But I also think that there are many accounts in his books that are really chilling. These, you know, when he writes about blood falling from the sky, and he writes about account after account after account after account with the dates and the places and the accounts of what it was looked at and how it was examined and the laboratory that it went to, because people said, well, it can't be that. It must be kind of red mud.
Yeah.
And then, of course, the kind of great storytelling of Fort, you know, he just keeps upping the ante. And then he gives you the account of the flakes of beef that fell from the sky. And, you know, all of this is just, I mean, it is really like a horror story, but it's done in this very methodical, very simple manner. And then he speculates. I mean, he writes about what scientists said. Oh, it must have been vultures, you know, that ate something and then disgorged it in the air. And then he writes about that. He writes about the possibility of that and what the evidence shows. So, you know, the stories, they're kind of beautifully organized in how they build. And I think his first book, Book of the Damned, is kind of brilliantly done in this way that, it, as I said, it's slightly hard to read at the beginning because there's a lot of his speculation and a lot of his kind of science, philosophy of science woven in at the beginning. And gradually these phenomena just keep marching. As he says, you know, the damned will march for you, and you'll have to deal with them. And these phenomena just keep marching through this book. And by the end of it, he really has kind of taken his voice and his point of view out of it, and he's just turned it over to this phenomenon. And it has a really chilling effect as you read it even today, because it's almost as if the narrator has been overwhelmed by these things. And you just keep reading more and more and more of this.
Was he writing fiction or nonfiction?
He was certainly a very capable fiction writer, his short stories. But it's nonfiction. And, it flabbergasted people at the time, but I think he was so careful from the earliest books to put the accounts in, to put all the source material in, to very artfully let you know what the comments were, what the commentators said, what the evidence shows, what the observers said, what the later scientists said. All of that is there. And so I think it absolutely overwhelmed people when they read it. They realized that this was nonfiction. He's really gathered all these facts and put them together.
Fascinating. He really is. I mean, one of a kind.
It really is. I think in many ways, again, it's interesting because he was the first of so much of this. I mean, many of these subjects that we know today, they all stem from Fort. But at the same time, it's just never been quite the same. I mean, I think in terms of a literary style and in terms of his own point of view, in terms of presenting this without taking a stand, without proposing anything, and always keeping a kind of sense of humor about the strangeness of the world around us, it really is one of a kind.
Truly is. A remarkable individual who probably would have succeeded nowadays, don't you think?
I do think so. His personality is so unusual and so kind of contrary to any kind of social interaction that I think he was much the product of his day. And I also think that, you know, the 1920s, when this book came out, were really a time of social change. I mean, I write a little about that. I mean, it was a very frightening time for much of society. There were terrorists. I mean, it's very much like today in the sense that there was a Red Scare in the United States, and there were bombs in the streets, and there were package bombs that were being sent to politicians in 1919 and 1920. And America was really being frightened, and not only America, but the rest of the world. I mean, they just come through the World War. And so it was a time when people were looking at things in interesting ways, and Fort was there with the right kind of story.
Jim, when we come back, we'll take some calls with you next. I'd like you, when you check in, perhaps you have a Fortean-type story to share with us. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.